Purpose Projects.
Welcome to Purpose Projects, the podcast where we get to know people and businesses who are doing what they're doing for a greater purpose. Coming to you after our kickoff episode, and yes, guys, you heard it right. For those people who did not really pay much attention in English class, this podcast episode at least might not be really for you. No, just kidding. Because today, yes, you heard it right, we are talking in English. And I have the pleasure, first of all, to still not be doing this alone, but still with my very good friend, Moritz. Hello there again, Mo.
Hey again, Boris. What a start. Second episode and already international. I'm really excited for this episode. And yeah, last time we talked about food waste. And yeah, this week we're talking about another big topic.
Yes, indeed. This one today is a very, very extra special episode for us. And I'll let you do the honor of telling us why this is such a special episode for us today.
Thanks, Boris. Well, on today's podcast, we're delighted and very excited to talk to Sean Frankson, the co-founder and CTO of Plastic Bank. Sean is making plastic waste a currency in order to fight plastic waste and poverty. So far, his company has recovered over 11 million kilograms of plastic and helped thousands of people fight poverty. Well, to put his business in a nutshell, they give value to plastic, so plastic is not waste anymore. They do so by first building recycling ecosystems in coastal communities all around the world. Then the plastic gets collected by the people, which in exchange receive not only money, but also financial inclusion. Because Sean, he's a techie, and he also has a blockchain-based bank account, which he, introduced to the world. And finally, the collected plastic is sorted and recycled into the so-called social plastic. And this social plastic is then used by the partners of Social Bank to, for example, make, shampoo bottles and stuff like that. And on top of all of that, Sean is the perfect guest because he is an expert when it comes to purpose. He's been on uncountable TV interviews, and he's even had a TED Talk. And I'm really excited to get to know you, Sean. Welcome to Purpose Projects.
Perfect. Thanks for having me.
All the way from Vancouver, Canada. I think we didn't mention that at all. Or did you, Mo?
I didn't, but I'm guessing the people could already know we're not just talking English just for the fun of it. Sean is all the way in this podcast from Vancouver, Canada. And Sean, why don't you introduce yourself and maybe talk about your tattoos, because we read that that's maybe, or like your life motto.
Yeah, so, I always like to say that my story kind of started after high school, like a normal person, started playing in a rock band, started getting tattoos. Then I was about 22, as in a near-death car accident, a head-on collision. And it gave me the beautiful time to kind of think about life and think about what I wanted to do, and realize music wasn't really a passion. It was more of a strategy to meet girls. I'd met my wife in that period. So, when I had this about month where I could barely move, but I could think and I could just, start to plan, I realized I wanted to be an international strategist, just a change the world strategist, no clue what that looked like. And that's when I started kind of piecing things together and kind of came up with the core recipe of what I thought would be my big success formula, which was to create opportunities, inspire purpose, and to strategize. So I now have full sleeve tattoos, with the sleeves being my values: to create, inspire, and strategize. And 7 Habits of Highly Effective People are also the other main showpiece I have on my tattoos. And I really just kind of looked at what were the things that were just so important to my path that I never wanted them out of sight, out of mind, and became so important that I tattooed my sleeves as a commitment.
That sounds like quite a start for a very young life at that age. Would you mind maybe getting a little bit deeper, perhaps, into that? Because a lot of our listeners might be, I hope so, at least, younger people that are trying to make a start or a head start in to build a career, or just starting to like gain experiences in the work life. What were, you would say, your first steps that you took to get on this path that led you to where you are today?
Yeah, the beautiful thing became once I kind of had a direction to move towards, or all of a sudden was, you know, a way to make decisions. I realized that playing in a rock band to change the world strategist had a bit of an experience gap when I first made that commitment. So what I started to do is look at how could I create small businesses to get paid in experience so that I could kind of just rapidly learn what I liked to do, what I didn't like to do. And I really took the approach of, it took a little bit of time to get going, but if I waited for other people to present opportunities, it would take way too long, especially because I felt I was a little bit behind playing in a band and not going straight to school or anything. So even when I went to university, I recruited 100 or about 70 people at my university to create a social enterprise where we just did consulting and small business startups aimed to get everyone paid in experience. After that, I incorporated my own company doing, I guess it was mainly marketing, web design, and integrated videos, where I just learned one step ahead of the client how to do all that stuff. But again, just wanted to pay myself an experience. I hosted an online series called Cool in Vancouver, where I was kind of the video host for drinking, dining, and entertainment recommendations. But all of this was really geared towards, you know, if I could create my own show, create my own site, I then can create my own portfolio to then go to clients and say, look, here's my stuff. And I did that for a little while. And then probably about 13 years ago now, David Katz, my current business partner, he had a GPS tracking technology company, and he was looking for someone to start the marketing department by scratch. So, you know, I kind of came in, had my portfolio of all the things I'd created and said, look, I've been spending the last 3 years preparing for this opportunity. You know, here's exactly where the fit is. And about a year after that, when I was about 27, I became vice president of that whole company and then was able to co-found the Plastic Bank with David by the time I was about 29.
That's a pretty impressive path to your, yeah, now really successful company. I read that your estimated sales for this year is like about $65 million. And that's, yeah, quite a number if you think about plastic, because yeah, before our research we thought plastic is waste. So question, why don't you just give us a quick insight about your business model and explain why plastic should not be seen as waste?
Yeah, I mean, biggest thing is once plastic's fully sorted, it's fully recyclable. There's so many myths about recycling. And you know, when we first got into the business, what it, especially 7 years ago, there wasn't this giant demand for ocean plastic. There wasn't this giant awareness. Most companies still hadn't made their giant commitments that by 2025, they're going to just be using recycled plastic. And there's usually a lot of misinformation where quite often a manufacturer would just say it's easier to buy new plastic, so we don't use recycled plastic. And you start to have all these like myths about it. And what we found is when these large companies like the Henkel of the world tell their manufacturers, we need to use recycled plastic, they flip the switch and can do recycled plastic very easy. But what's interesting is, you know, in the places that we operate, when everything comes in by like sorted by hand, I thought this would be a big challenge of how do you get high quality hand sorted plastic. But it turns out that when someone's sorting by hand, bringing in just the clear PET in this bottle, the green PET, the HDPE, once it's sorted and never gets mixed, it becomes an incredibly high quality source of plastic. And pound for pound, sorted plastic is worth more than steel. It's also lighter, more convenient to move. But the big thing is, in so many places of the world, people look at it as waste picking, scavenging, a last resort. So when we started to look at, you know, why is it being treated as waste? Why is it so abundantly littered? We found 80% of the world's ocean plastic comes in developing countries where there's almost no waste management systems. And then on top of that, there's quite often this stigma that, yeah, it's a scavenging, a waste picking. So when we came in at the Plastic Bank, we realized, you know, it's not just how do we keep recycling going the way it is, because the way it is not working in most places of the world. And when we started to look at how do we create a social plastic, where yes, we're stopping ocean-bound plastic in ocean-bound areas, but that's really just a starting point. How do we dignify recycling where in our programs, we actually pay a special bonus on top of the market rate of plastic. So someone earns above the market rate of plastic, we're introducing another benefits kind of contribution on top of that that goes towards giving someone their first ever bank account, their first access to loans, and even with the long-term goal of building out a pension fund that someone can earn through recycling. And all of this goes beyond just kind of the poorest of the poor. We also look at how do all the community members also recycle. Some don't do it for money. Some do it because of the membership benefits they can. Some do it because it's free food. It's free cooking fuel. It's free things by exchanging it at their market because they're just using the plastic at their feet. But what we found is when we really work on dignifying recycling, when we include the entire community, now everyone sees plastic as value. They see the people as doing something valuable. And we strive to make recycling not the end point, but the starting point to a better life. Which even as someone who's kind of self-obsessively obsessed with purpose-driven missions, you know, my challenge is how do you take someone from that absolute base of the pyramid and get them on a path where they can actually find purpose in what they're doing, providing for their family, and really see that hope, really see this, you know, everything in that new life and that hierarchy of needs of unlocking purpose is really my goal, really for anyone involved in our program at any level.
Yeah, Sean, I gotta tell you, honestly, it's hard not to get inspired while listening to you. I think Moritz, you might feel quite the same. I want to quickly just get back to, you already mentioned your partners that you're working with. Since you know that we are right now, at least I am, I mean, both of us, Moritz and I, we're coming to you from Germany, I specifically in Düsseldorf, where one of your biggest partners in Henkel is, they have their headquarters here. I would like to know, how exactly is the process of you coming together with such a big partner? Or you're also working with Aldi and SC Johnson and IBM and a lot of other great companies. But how does the process exactly look like from having an idea to work with someone to ending up really working with someone?
For sure. And, you know, and Henkel is just such a great example of a beautiful partner. I remember it was so hard to try to get, you know, the first opportunities, people to, you know, hear a vision and say, let's bring it to life. So Henkel is one of the first ones that really kind of came and, you know, said, honestly, we get you're figuring things out. We're fine with that. We're comfortable figuring things out with you. One of the beautiful things with Henkel as well, since Henkel is technically a family company, there's a lot of legacy behind what Henkel means and their products means, which also meant there was a lot of opportunity to look at, you know, this isn't a marketing campaign. This isn't a one thing. If we're doing this, like, we need to grow together to be the size that they need us to be in the long run. So with,
and do you, do you think that's like a German thing? Because a lot of your big customers are actually right here around the corner. And you just earlier mentioned the demand. Do you feel like the shift of demand just changed here on the German market compared to other markets?
Yeah, and I definitely say to me the shift of demand changed almost first in Germany. And yeah, I would say Europe, but as you've seen, most of our clients are huge German-based. And where I find there's a big difference too, and I won't name names, but we've talked to some companies that just want the cheapest way to slap ocean plastic on a product. We have had companies say, look, I'm going to stop you there. We don't care about the social impact. We just need to say it came from the ocean. And
so that's what the people always talk about greenwashing, right?
Yeah. So especially say when we started, there was a lot where that was all some people were looking for. What I found, usually in Europe alone, you do not get the same degree of greenwashing like at all that you get in the US or North America. And then in Germany, I think there's usually just this almost extra standard of what doing something the right way is. So in a great way, our model is really built for someone that wants to go above the right way. Like, that's how we operate, because that's our trust. That's our brand. And I think we really connected with a lot of companies that get, look, recycled plastic is just going to be table stakes. That's just everyone's going to need to use recycled plastic. How do we actually get recycled plastic that can pass audits back to where it got collected, the regions. And, you know, we usually connect with a lot of companies as well. We like to call it beyond sustainability, but the regenerative economy, where how do we make every community better than it was before for our programs being there, not just take from the community, but build that community up. And I think that's something our partners have connected with us a lot, where you know, they're proud of a social plastic. And even a company like Henkel has been a great example where for them, it's not so much even how the consumer sees the bottle. They want every single person in the company to recognize that purpose is happening within this company. And that when you get that holistic view of everyone being proud of what you're doing, and if you're proud of it, your consumers should recognize that as well. You know, that really just becomes the way we look for that values aligned. And yeah, a lot of the German companies, I'd say just the standard of doing it right was much ahead of where a lot of companies have caught up to over time.
But Sean, why do you think, I would like to a little, just one short question, Mo. Why do you think there is such an difference in how the Americas, or I'm not sure how it is in Canada, but there's certainly also a cultural difference to the US, I'm sure. Why is there such a different, I would like to call it, I don't know, maybe you can correct me, mindset in what's the right thing to do? Or is it really, as you just mentioned, like sort of like I don't care attitude towards those kind of topics overseas as opposed to Europe, as you mentioned?
Yeah, and it kind of changes by company. And then I'll say it's not really just that Europe versus North America. Sure. As I'd say, our experience with SC Johnson has been almost identical where, but again, the interesting thing, SC Johnson's a family company with a legacy behind it. Fisk Johnson, the CEO, is a scuba diver, very passionate about the oceans. And I'd say they've been the same kind of thing. When we get in, there's a right way to do it. And, you know, I just think even probably like 5 to 10 years before the sustainability wave hit North America, it was already incredibly active in Europe. So I think there's also been more of a business mindset that there's a timeline before we got to be competing on social good or else people stop buying our products. And now we're at the point, though, where the world's getting so transparent where, you know, one bad Google search, one bad picture can like take down a company. You know, when I did my TED talk, one of my favorite lines that I liked was just kind of that epiphany that if people stop buying products, those products stop getting made. If people stop buying from a company, that company goes out of business. And we now are literally in the world of like hashtag boycott, where this is a real thing where the masses have realized that they can take down giants. So it is now risky business not to be ahead of the curve on your environmental and social impacts.
Sure.
And that probably also explains why these companies are also willing to pay more for social plastic than create new plastic.
Exactly.
Is it true that social plastic is like about 30% more expensive than making it?
Well, it really depends. The hard thing with plastic is new plastic's always based on oil prices. So, you know, oil's been up, down, crazy. It's usually it kind of has that direct correlation. I think now for the first time in the world, it's almost separated from the price of oil just because there's more demand for recycled plastic than there is on the market, which is where a lot of our clients aren't just buying plastic. They're investing in our capacity to expand. Even someone like Henkel's just invested in our movement into Egypt to get Egypt as an entire sourcing. And a lot of our programs really look to build our capacity to meet their demand. And we look at it in two ways too. So, you know, if you look at purely the price of a supply chain, like just buying a plastic, yes, our plastic's a little bit more expensive, but if you are buying a plastic and then doing your own reporting, auditing, setting up everything, then all of a sudden this starts to get cheaper than doing them both separately, just because we're able to put that value directly to those people in the bottom. And we really build everything we do to be exponentially scalable through our platform so that when you look at that whole piece of what does it cost to do it right, to have an audit-proof, transparent supply chain, you know, all the reward systems in place. And, you know, I always look at the hard thing with supply chain when you first get into it, nobody gets a raise for spending more on a supply chain. But, you know, at the same note, when you have blind supply chains, we're seeing in every industry, it'd be unacceptable to have the lowest price coffee bean possible. And when you have the lowest price of anything possible, it is not pretty when you uncover how that price came. So we work with our clients to ensure that there's a price floor that it should never go below for their own sake, you know, let alone our programs.
Yeah, for sure. Let us maybe just hit the switch a little bit and talk about like Plastic Bank as a company itself. Would you mind just explaining or elaborating a little bit on where your guys are really active as of right now, in which countries, how many recycled plastic stations do you have for collectors to go to? And maybe just in brief, everything that's important to know about Plastic Bank.
Sure. So yeah, we just passed over actually 12 million kilos of recycled plastic this month. We're at about 1 million kilos a month. COVID took a little bit of a knockdown as quarantines literally shut down certain areas. But as that's opening back up, we're now back over that 1 million kilos per month. And this is kind of on half operations right now with 1 million kilos per month. So we're fully active in Haiti, Indonesia, Philippines, and just launching in Brazil, and Egypt is the next kind of one we're fully staffed on. And again, as COVID came, we kind of had to slow anything down until it was safe to go into new areas and start something new without, you know, going and disrupting the way quarantines and all of that operate. So yeah, over 300 plastic bank collection points in our different countries. And it's really going to wrap up or ramp up as we grow here, where, you know, we're also going beyond just our own plastic bank locations. So we either create something where nothing's there, or else we certify existing ecosystems. So instead of coming in and competing and shutting down hardworking entrepreneurs, we essentially offer them the ability to become plastic bank certified, use our digital system, qualify their members and themselves for our membership rewards. And most of the countries we're now looking at very soon adding automated health insurance is something that everyone gets. So this just becomes a way we keep looking at how might we add more dignity, more value. And the programs will continue just to expand each new regions, usually a little bit of a variation. It's never been cookie cutter for us, but it's fun to learn a new culture, you know, a new way to operate that they feel like it's their local plastic bank.
The plastic bank, like I said in my introduction, you guys are fighting not only the plastic waste, but also poverty. So maybe let's elaborate a bit on that. You just mentioned you're in countries just like Haiti or the Philippines. How do the people in the Philippines benefit off of the social bank, the plastic bank? Sorry.
Yeah, well, it kind of depends on the country, but really for any, like, you know, even one of the design challenges here, often when someone says, oh, the Philippines, 95% of everyone has a cell phone. That means the poorest people don't. So most of our users, and especially from a digital point of building up the platform, most of our actual core users are someone that's illiterate and has never used a phone before. And we need to have our programs work around ensuring that the most vulnerable people are the ones most looked after. So our programs, we actually, through our blockchain technology, we give someone their first ever ID. We give them their first ever digital savings account. We have a way to help them get to earn and unlock their first phone, but still a way that they can safely, even without a phone, get that trusted ID, have a savings account that they can use at our locations as we continue to go down this path. We've had to learn even that our membership training involves just basic literacy, like reading programs, financial literacy, to get someone in that ability to start to see, you know, the next stages in life. And really, we've had to just not just treat it as a plastic recycling program. And in my mind, too, I really just treat it as how can I have the world's best, you know, membership perks program that really encourages all people of all levels to see the value of participating, you know, in this regenerative society.
Yeah, you guys are really tackling all three pillars of sustainability. So economically, ecologically, and social. Boris and I are going to link some YouTube videos of you guys in the show notes, which I think explains like the story, especially of these people, pretty nicely, because I hope a lot of people will now know about the plastic bank. But I'm even guessing a lot of people don't even know about the environmental pollution problem that much. So you said that every minute a truck of plastic is wasted or dumped into the ocean. What problem do you actually solve if you just recycle those bottles or that plastic waste?
Yeah, no, great question. It's kind of funny. There's been this giant debate of, does recycling work? Do we need alternatives? How do we do it? You know, it always just terrified me when it first came out that, oh, we found the solution to ocean plastic. There's someone who's going to scoop it out of the ocean. And to call that the solution to ocean plastic means humanity has no choice but to just treat the ocean as a garbage dump and someone else will clean it up. And when we first looked at that, you know, really the paradigm is the responsible consumer, that if I as a consumer choose to buy something plastic, I should know that I can recycle it and bring it to the right place. Otherwise, that's probably a poor choice. And where I obsess over this is if fully closed loop, and again, in Canada, we have these green or blue bins that we can put our recycled in, it's sorted and gets recycled. When fully closed loop, we can recycle again and again, which is much better than using up farmland, water, everything to still make a disposable material. So to me, the big paradigm is when we only buy or use a plastic that can either be fully permanent or fully closed loop, this is a really effective material. But the concept of let's just get rid of plastic and replace it with something else that we discard, that we throw out, you know, to me, this is where everything starts to get more complex. So for us, we can fully have a society that regenerates everything we use. And that's the big paradigm, and really need to get rid of disposable anything, like whether it's any material almost. And this is really where society has to go, because we just can't sustain our own planet. Same goes for food. Okay. Same goes for a lot of things.
Yeah, sure.
I also have I have to ask this question. So I have this idea of, it's been in my head for like a couple of years, of making a sustainable hot sauce. And what do you guys, or how do you guys open up for maybe like people like me who have like an idea, who maybe my idea is like, I want a social plastic bottle where the hot sauce is inside. Is there any possibility for like a young guy like me to get in contact with your plastic bank company to get social plastic, or do you have to be the big Henkel company?
It kind of depends. So one, economically, sometimes it's not the best to ship things all around the world for like small run production. So it always depends where something's being done, which is usually where we aim for the larger companies, just because we're not wasting anything. We're typically manufacturing close to where they're, or collecting close to where they manufacture. But what we have different programs is for companies of all sizes. So we have it that companies can go plastic positive, where they offset more plastic than they use as a company. We have a lot of product lines that don't actually use our plastic. They use the plastic at the, you know, closest to get recycled plastic to their facility, but still transfer that value into our ecosystems by helping to offset more than they use. And that's usually what we have on those smaller scale things, of being able to offset more plastic than you use, still use a recycled plastic locally. And then when the volumes are big enough that it makes sense to ship something, and environmentally it makes sense to get it to that point, then that's when we really find that fix. And, you know, we often have these different ways of working with people at different stages. And hopefully all of our smaller clients grow to the point that they then become a large enough person to be able to be part of the larger supply chains.
Sean, a wise man once said, with great power comes great responsibility. I'm sure you know who I'm hinting at.
Good old Ben Parker.
Yes, indeed. Maybe to sort of like get to the direction of wrapping things up. In your opinion, what's the real significance of purpose for companies today? And do you also would have any advice for companies who are striving for young talents but don't really have a deeper purpose, so to say? Or do you even think that this kind of business model without a purpose has a future at all?
Yeah, I love this topic, because to me, there's a couple of things that's so new going forward, and that we're finding so many companies, when purpose just becomes good business, it doesn't matter if you're a purpose company, buying more purposeful products just becomes good business. But what we're finding is a lot of younger people especially want to work for purpose. So another thing of good business is to make your company more purposeful to attract and retain talent. And what I've found in my big thing that I say to a lot of people, before you look at quitting for purpose, really see if you can be that purpose agent inside your own company who brings it and makes it happen. Because it may not have been acceptable 10 years ago, but now the people that says, look, I have an idea of how we can be more purposeful, these are the people getting great opportunities, because people are starting to see this is the future. So I'd say, regardless of whether you create your own business, you join a purpose business, or you become a champion to turn your existing business into purpose, it all kind of goes, and everybody has the power to play a part in a life of purpose.
Awesome. Yeah, really. Makes all the sense in the world to me, definitely.
Sean, thank you so much for giving us insights about, yeah, responsible consumerism, but also about profit and purpose. You guys are solving two global problems at once. And yeah, we're really happy if we stay in contact. Thank you very much.
Perfect. Thanks for having me, guys.
So, Moritz, jetzt sag ich das mal in der zweiten Folge bei uns. Puh, ziemlich inspirierender Talk, oder? Was würdest du sagen? Deine ersten Eindrücke?
Ja, auf jeden Fall eine krasse Maschine, der Typ. Ja,
gut ausgedrückt.
Das, vor allem, als er am Anfang da über seinen Werdegang schon erzählt hat, ne? Also der hat auch wirklich nicht alles erwähnt, aber da war schon genug Großes dabei.
Ich glaub, das hat gereicht, oder?
Können wir gerne. Ja, ich glaube, wir können hier jedem Zuhörer und jeder Zuhörerin einmal empfehlen, einmal sein Twitter oder seine Website oder was auch immer einmal abzuchecken. Ja. Da kriegt man schon einen ganz guten Eindruck darüber, was ja oder wie viele Stunden sein Tag hat. Mhm. Was sagst du zu seinen Antworten?
Boah, ich finde, ehrlich gesagt, ich finde es immer ein bisschen schwierig, also wenn man einen Interviewpartner hat, also generell muss man erstmal sagen, wir sind sehr, sehr froh, dass er überhaupt zugestimmt hat mit uns zwei ziemlich unbekannten noch deutschen Jungs, die einen Podcast gestartet haben, überhaupt.
Ja, aber baldiges Millionenpublikum.
Ja, das haben wir ja, das haben wir ja schon im Trailer gesagt, das haben wir ja nicht umsonst gesagt und er hilft uns natürlich sehr dabei, das zu erreichen. Aber noch sind wir nicht so weit und deshalb haben wir uns ja gefreut, dass er überhaupt am Start war. Nichtsdestotrotz, lange Antwort, finde ich es immer ein bisschen schwierig, wenn man seinem Interviewgast eine Frage stellt und dann aber so eine 7-minütige Antwort kommt. Was bei ihm aber wiederum ganz cool ist wieder. Also du merkst, ich bin noch ein bisschen unentschlossen. Ich fand den super inspirierend, habe ich ja auch gesagt so, ne? Also es ist schwer, dann nicht irgendwie hyped zu werden bei allem, was er sagt und so. Ja, deswegen. Ich bin mal gespannt, was du dir so gedacht hast, weil die Antworten waren auch ziemlich lang und die haben auch ziemlich viel enthalten. Also das muss man ja auch alles erstmal verarbeiten.
Genau, also der hat echt viele Insights gegeben. Generell Plastic Bank ist auch echt ein sehr komplexes Geschäftsmodell, das Ganze auch zu verstehen. Ich habe das am Anfang hoffentlich kurz und knapp einmal erklärt. Ich hoffe, es haben alle verstanden. Danach ist er halt immer so ein bisschen wieder drauf eingegangen. Ich natürlich bin jetzt ein bisschen enttäuscht, dass er jetzt nicht gesagt hat, ey, Moritz, klar, ich gebe dir hier so ein Social Plastic und dann starten wir eine Chilisauce zusammen. Mhm. Aber gut, das müssen wir dann halt.
Try.
Nein, hat echt mega Spaß gemacht. Sean ist echt ein super Typ, der wirklich was auf dieser Welt verändern möchte. Allein diese ganze Thematik wie Armut, Plastik, aber auch irgendwie so Recycling-Ökosysteme auch zusammenhängen.
Ja.
Mega, ja, ist einfach ein Riesenproblem. Riesenproblem, was er da zusammen mit seinem anderen Founder, dem David Katz angeht.
Ja.
Das ist diese Person, die nehmen echt die größten Aufgaben und jetzt in diesem Fall sogar die zwei Riesenaufgaben und sagen, damit machen wir jetzt ein Business. Und ja, verleihen uns, unser ganzes Unternehmen, allen unseren Partnern, unser ganzes Netzwerk einen Purpose. Das ist für mich echt so ein Geschäftsmodell der Zukunft. Und ja, ich bin gespannt, wen wir noch alles in den Podcast bekommen.
Ja, auf jeden
Boris,
Fall.
Boris, was sagst du zu unserer Leistung auf Englisch?
Boah, ich habe keine Ahnung, wenn ich ehrlich bin. Also ich weiß nicht, das ist früher wie im war ein bisschen so das Feeling wie, guck mal, Feeling, ich bin jetzt schon im Modus. So ein bisschen wie früher im Englisch-LK, wenn man auch irgendwie nie antworten wollte, aber musste. Man muss sich halt dann auch mal challengen. So, ich komme da nicht mehr raus. Nee,
muss sich auch mal melden, Boris.
Man muss sich auch mal melden, ja genau. Und im Podcast, wenn man halt nichts sagt, ist halt auch blöd. Deshalb, aber ich glaube, wir haben uns schon ganz gut geschlagen. Also wir sind ja jetzt nicht die allergrößten Englisch-Legastheniker. Das war überhaupt der Grund, warum wir uns das überhaupt zugetraut haben. Ich weiß nicht, müssen dann unsere Zuhörerinnen sagen, wie wir uns geschlagen haben. Aber ich glaube, es war ganz okay.
Ja, Stichwort Zuhörer und Zuhörerinnen. Vielen Dank für euer ganzes Feedback von unserer ersten Folge und fürs Teilen weiter. Wir haben uns echt mega gefreut. Jetzt habt ihr so gut begonnen. Ich hoffe, da genau so macht ihr weiter. folgt uns auf unseren Kanälen und ja, ich freue mich auf die nächste Folge schon wieder.
Ich freue mich sehr. Ihr dürft auf jeden Fall gespannt sein. Wir halten euch immer up to date, wenn ihr uns überall folgt. Bei Instagram, wir sind sogar auf Twitter, Moritz.
Ja, wir haben, glaube ich, schon 12 Follower.
Ja, ja, es wächst jeden Tag. Ich komme da gar nicht mehr mit. Deswegen Followerzahlen zu nennen, ist immer so eine Sache. Ihr könnt auch an der Stelle Sean Frankson folgen. Übrigens, der hat ein paar Follower mehr als wir. Aber
ich glaube, der hat 142.000 und 12.
Ja, ich glaube, da kannst du nochmal 100.000 draufpacken. Egal, auf jeden Fall freuen wir uns sehr über jeden Einzelnen, der uns folgt. Und ja, wir hören uns in der nächsten Folge wieder.
Ciao.